Okay, let's get started. Parshat Shoftim, welcome everybody. I'll start, I'm sure, I don't know how many people are aware that tonight is the 3rd of Elul. Of course, by the way, this is the beginning of school. And since I teach, at Chats, it's like my summer's over, it's like, when I was working as an accountant, September Labor Day didn't mean much. But when you work as a teacher, it's a whole different world. So Labor Day and the summer is like, like all the students, I have the same year as they do. But this year, of course, school started on Tuesday. I know in the southern states, they start before, but in the East Coast, we start on the day after Labor Day, always in Toronto. So we started on the first day of Rosh Chodesh, on the 30th day of Ab. I don't remember that ever happening. It requires Rosh Hashanah to be really, really late, and it requires Labor Day to be really, really early. So the first day of school was the 30th of Ab, which is actually cool. Usually school starts in Elul. So we have a whole month to blow shofar. And of course, about 3 years ago, I don't remember exactly when, school started after Rosh Hashanah. I also don't remember that happening. Basically, Labor Day was very late that year. Labor Day was like September the 8th. Or something, and school started. Rosh Hashanah was basically Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, and school started on Wednesday on Som Gedalia. So that's also very rare. We've often had school starting on Tuesday, and often, occasionally, and Rosh Hashanah is Wednesday night. Anyways, the perks of the calendar when you try to combine the lunar and the solar calendar, and when you do school year based on every day, I actually like this much better. Because it gives me a whole month to teach about Yontif and stuff. Like it's hard to teach about Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur if you're starting school after Rosh Hashanah. That's it. You can't teach about Rosh Hashanah. It's like Bal Tosif. Okay, but today is the first.
Rabbi, talking about the calendar, it's not very often that we have not on Chol HaMoed 4 days that we read the Torah. So this happened this week.
For 4 days, where do you get four? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Yeah, whenever Rosh Chodesh is Tuesday, Wednesday, so you read the 4 days in a row. Yeah.
It doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't happen so often, right? It happens like, let's say, once in a blue moon, but whatever, okay. I asked my kids, in my grade 10 class in rabbinics that I teach, so the first unit of the year is actually on the calendar. That's the first unit we do. And the holidays, so it actually works in very well. But so I asked the kids, what's a blue moon? Do people here know what the definition of a blue moon is? There is an official definition of a blue moon. We use, once in a blue moon. A blue moon is when there are two full moons in one month. So like, if the 15th of the lunar month is the first of the month, so 29 days later, whatever, they're going to have two full moons. Anyways, that's just interesting. Okay, that happens once in a blue moon. It happens every probably 2.5 to 3 years. Okay, but tonight is the 3rd of Elul. So let's get into it. So why is the 3rd of Elul important? I mean, in the 20th century, which two great figures? One, most people will know. The second one is sort of a stretch. But which great figure, of course, is associated with the 3rd of Elul? Anybody know? Tonight is the Yortzeit of Rav Kook, Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. The first chief rabbi of Israel, passed away in 1935 on the 3rd of Elul, born in 1865. People don't necessarily associate him because they're very different. But he was one of the top students of the Netziv, the Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Rosh Yeshiva in Valashin, comes to Israel, of course, in 1904. I believe becomes the chief rabbi of Jaffa. Tel Aviv doesn't exist yet. Tel Aviv is only in existence in 1909. Rav Kook leaves Israel in 1914 to go to the first convention, or the one, not the first, but the major convention, first major convention of Agudat Israel. The Aguda was founded in 1912. I think they went to Switzerland, and World War I broke out when he was in Europe, and he ended up in Europe for 5 years before he could get back with his wife and whatever. He just went in Europe. He was in England and different places. He came to Canada, I believe, in 1924, Rav Kook, and he passed away in Israel in 1935. I believe Rav Soloveitchik met him just before he passed away. Rav Soloveitchik visited Israel only once in his life in 1935 to apply for the job of chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. And Baruch Hashem, he came in a distant third. There were three candidates. Rav Amiel won the job. I think he got like 2 votes out of 90, Baruch Hashem, because the Rav in 1935 was an Agudaist. And this Israel was looking for a Mizrachiist rabbi, and he lost. But he gave shiurim. People remember him. I hear stories. People who were at the shiur Rav Soloveitchik gave. He was young. He was 1935. He was only 32. And people said he's too young to apply for the chief rabbinate. And his father wrote a letter. No, that will change over time. Maybe he's young now, but in a few years he won't be so young. But anyways, thank God he didn't get the job. And I'm sure many of you know. In 1959, I will have to have Rav Herzog. That's, of course, the current president's grandfather, when Rav Herzog, Isaac Halevi, Yitzchak Halevi Herzog, died. So they offered Rav Kook the position of chief rabbi. And by that time, he was smart enough not to take it.
Rav, not Rav Kook.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Somebody's listening. They answered about my sister. Okay. They offered Rav Soloveitchik the job of chief rabbi, and it really has to do, and this is really, in a sense, ties in this week's Parsha. A rabbi can't be a functionary. A rabbi can't, as he put it, a rabbi can't be institutionalized. The rabbi has to be totally independent, and that's not the way it works. Politics and religion are shatnefs, and the rabbi understood that, and he accepted. So that's, anyways, I think it's just important to point out tonight's Rav Kook's Yortzeit. I think, even though I really am not a student of Rav Kook, I haven't read his writings really. I don't know. It just doesn't appeal to me. Maybe I don't understand it. Wrong country. It's just not my world. I'm not in that mystical world. But of course, he's extremely influential. And we've mentioned many times in other contexts that Rav Kook was, of course, a messianist, Zionist. He believed in, this is the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. This is, the state of Israel is the messianic process, something Rav Soloveitchik did not at all go for, and something Rav Reines, the founder of Mizrahi, didn't go for. So I mentioned many times today, that's the dominant view. The religious Zionist movement today is almost totally messianic, the whole movement, and it impacts their politics and whatever. And the view that I like, the Rav Soloveitchik view, it's very wonderful. There's the state of Israel, but it has nothing to do with the coming of the Messiah. The two are totally unrelated. It's very dangerous to impute messianic overtones. But Rav Kook, of course, did. And Rav Kook, of course, is extremely influential. And he, of course, had one son, Tzvi Yehuda Kook. I remember him, sort of, when I was in Yeshivat HaKotel. He was still in Merkaz HaRav. He lived to be in his 90s, I believe, Rav Kook. And, of course, his famous speech before the Sixth War. Okay, enough of that. The other person I want to associate with Gimel Elul, who I had a personal relationship with, but was I was a student of them in the classroom for a year, and I did visit with them, a little bit of a personal relationship, of course. On the other end of the spectrum, it's her birthday. It would be today her 119th birthday, 1905, right? We're 119 years from 1905.
Born
on Gimel Elul in Riga. And so I find that very interesting, that the Yortzeit of Rav Kook and the birthday of Nechama Leibowitz are on Gimel Elul, of course, and where this is a Parsha Shir, who better to, have insights into Chumash than Nechama, as she insisted on being called Nechama, and she was really, really an amazing woman. And those who had the privilege to study with her, even though her style, people don't use her style anymore. She taught all the next generation, because her style was, it's like, how should I say, we're a lazy generation. We're an art scroll generation. We want everything all spoon-fed. Nechama made you work. Nechama put you the Malbim and the Ramban, and you had to sit there and say, why did the Ramban and the Malbim disagree? What's their point of disagreement? And you had to write it down, and she would go, lo nachon, and you had to think, today, just open up the art scroll, or what is Jonathan Sachs saying, and get your Dvar Torah, and that's what you do. Now, I mean that in all seriousness. It's a little bit sad, but this is our generation. We like everything spoon-fed. Nobody works out a Gemara anymore. It is as great as what art scroll, corn, whatever they've done. It's a lot of pluses, but there's a minus. There is a minus, a big minus. Nobody learns Gemara B'Iyun anymore. Nobody breaks their head. In the olden days, you took a Jastrow and you sat there. And yes, you didn't maybe accomplish as much, but you knew what you learned a lot better, and you learned how to learn. Anyways, that's Nechama's style, I think, has gone out of style. People don't like it. If you ever did her Gilyonot, they're a little bit different than her books, which she's more popular by. Anyways, that's just a brief introduction. Did Nechama Leibowitz have any contact relations with Rav Kook? I do not know, but I doubt it. Nechama arrived in Israel, I believe, also around 1935. I don't know the exact date. maybe a little bit earlier, she told us she left Israel once in her life. She came to Israel in the 30s. Like I say, she was born in 1905. She came to Israel. She did her PhD in, people don't know this, her PhD was done in German and English literature. And we asked her, I just assumed her PhD was in Bible. And she said, Professor Berlin Yadu Klum, Heim Lo Yadu Shum Davar. Like there was nobody there who could teach her anything. Hayom be Hebrew University, Yesh Kamanashim Yodim Ksat, Kamanashim be Hebrew University. You know, today a few people, the professors. So she learned Tanakh with her parents and on her own. But her PhD, she told us she could read English then faster than any of us. And we're all American born in her class, you know, and she, or Canadian born, North American born. But, and, you know, she's born in Russia, in Riga, whatever, and born in Riga. And, but she spoke a fluent English. I mean, she never spoke to us, and she always spoke in Hebrew, but I'm sure she spoke a fluent English, a fluent German, probably five other languages that I'm not aware of. But really, she developed all through. And it is a little bit sad that I did for a while, I had a chavrusa in her gilyonot. I used to go every week with many years ago. We took one of her, you know, which she never, of course, published answers to. That's part of her philosophy. 30 years she put out, he took a part of the Parsha, asked questions, like you said, what's the difference between the Ramban and Rashi? Why do they argue? And what's the, where do they base it on? And she, and you could write to her and she'd mark it. She'd mark it, but
she'd mark it and send it back to you.
Correct. Amazing. Amazing. I mean, the worst part of being a teacher in school is marking papers. It's only slightly, it's slightly worse than, our teacher meetings, you know, like what are the, I love being in the classroom, but what are the things I can't stand about teaching? You know, whatever teaches me the waste of time. Okay, I'm not, don't tell anybody in chat when I say this. Okay. But, you know, marking papers is a big pain, but okay. That's what you got to do. That's it comes with the territory. So she marked all these papers, but she never would publish answers because that's not. And as I've mentioned before, she refused. It's actually almost a tragedy. We don't have any recordings of her classes, as far as I know, because she refused to allow her classes to be recorded because Bahar Sinai, lo hayu tape recorders, as she said to us. And she didn't, you came to class every week or you didn't come at all. That was the rule for the first day. Zelo Country Club, Po. You come and you bring a Tanakh Shalem, and oy vai voy if you don't bring a Tanakh Shalem. And, you know, Julian, she was a pedagogue par excellence. So, and then we have to get into the part. This is I know I'm pinch hitting. I was supposed to give the Parsha here, but whatever. I mean, the Parsha here, but still we have to learn on the Parsha. But so we asked her if she knew Rabbi Soloveitchik, because they were both in University of Berlin. So at the same time, so that would have been quite a shidduch. But anyways, okay, that's I shouldn't talk like that. But anyways, so she said, not well, that she said. She said, she knew him, of course. She said that she was in Berlin first, University of Berlin, and they heard that Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son is coming to university. Ooh, and she said, I had my makom kavua here in the library, and he had his makom kavua over there in the library. You know, Rav Soloveitchik talked, he used to sit there. They had an unquenchable thirst of learning. Then in Berlin in the 30s, they just wanted to learn everything. They learned Yomam Valayla, but not only Torah, of course, philosophy, I mean, everything. They just had this tremendous thirst for learning. So whatever, they knew each other, but she said they weren't really close. They didn't have much to do with each other. But anyways, I see somebody pointing out Google says Nechama Leibowitz arrived in 1930. Okay, I didn't know exactly when. I knew it was in something in the 30s. So anyways, but she did leave Israel once in her life to visit her parents. That was the only time she left Israel to go visit her parents. She refused to leave Israel. And anyways, okay, she likely wasn't well-known in 1935. I assume she was not well-known. Like, of course. Yeah, okay. All right, let's start. So I want to, what did I call it this year? I forget, washing your hands or something like that. So did everybody figure out why I called this year this? Who wants to tell me why? You don't know. Okay, that's good. I mean, if you knew, maybe you'd figure out this year. Okay, so let me share my screen. Yeah, hello?
Because okay. you could wash your hands of the thing that happened in the city when the person was found.
Excellent. You're on the ball. Fantastic. Okay, that's correct. Exactly. So we're going to talk about Egla Arufa. We're going to start. We'll see how much other things we might do. Egla Arufa, which an egel means a calf. Arufa is the opposite of shechita, When you shecht an animal, you take a knife and you cut the front of the neck. Arufa, like amksheyorif, is the back of the neck. So the egel arufa had to be slaughtered from the back. Basically, as Annie is saying, the toward the end of the parsha, it's the last few verses of the parsha, they find a body in the middle of this, the middle of nowhere, and they don't know who killed the body. We have a whole ritual, a whole ceremony. So that's what we'll discuss. Right now, let me just share my screen, and we'll take a quick look at the psukim in the Chumash, and take it from there. Okay. Where are we here? Ki metzei chalal badama, chapter 21. When you find a chalal means a dead body. Asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha l'rishta, when you find in the land of Israel that God has given you. It's very interesting how they throw that in. Okay. And nafel besadeh lo nodam mihiko. You don't know how they got there. V'yatzu zechanecha v'shodrecha. The elders and the judges of the city, and they measure. They measure which is the closest city. The city that's closest, and remember, city didn't mean New York or Toronto. It meant like a little town of 100 people. That's got like the para aduma. You know, you can't have any work done with it. It's got to be a calf that is, you know, not carried any burdens. Asher lo mashka bo'ol. You never put a yoke on it. They have to take it to the water. Nothing grows. And they have to chop its head off, basically. I mean, cut it from the back of the neck. And the Kohanim, the priests, the religious leaders, because they're the ones, the Torah sort of throws in now in a side, like in brackets. Ki bam bachar Hashem alkecha l'shartu l'vrech v'shem Hashem. That really has nothing to do with it. Just like an aside. The Kohanim, why? Well, because they're the people who God has chosen to service them. The role of the Kohanim, I actually spoke today in my class in chapter. One of the other classes, the separation of church and state, that the role of the Kohanim are the religious leaders, and the role of the of Shevet Yehuda as the political leads. Like I said at the beginning, religion and politics mixing are shatnes. And, the Kohanim have their roles, the religion and the state is Shevet Yehuda. Okay. Okay. They're the ones, they're the religious leaders. So closing the year and all the elders of the city, Hakrovim el Hachalal, Yerchatsu et Yedem, they have to wash their hands. Very interesting. They have to wash their hands. Water is purification. Al Haglar Rufad. Sort of, they have to wash their hands on top of the dead calf. Va'anu v'amru yadenu. It's very interesting. You see, there's a hay. I imagine that's like we call a kriyuktiv, that it's written in the Torah with the hay, shavchu, but it's pronounced shavchu with like a vav. And they have to say, our hands did not spill this blood. Ve'inenu lo ra'inu. We don't know what happened. Kaper la'amcha. Atone, God, please atone for the sins. Asher patita v'atitein dam naki ber v'amcha. There shouldn't be innocent blood. Innocent blood is spilled. Unfortunately, too much of that is being spilled. V'nechaper l'hamadam. The blood should atone for them. V'atata ver dam naki mikrabecha. Okay, this is a very strange ritual. Some want to say it's a way to maybe if it's a murder, it brings publicity and maybe somebody will come forth with evidence. You know, they didn't have cameras back then and who knows what. But I want to let's focus on a few things here. We're not going to focus on everything. So I'll put my sister on the spot in a moment. So Vanu, yeah, don't worry, Tova. Vanu Avram, the elders have to say, we didn't kill this person. So there's a famous Rashi. Rashi's quoting the Gemara in Sota. By the way, what's the Gemara doing in Sota? Sota is about the adulterous woman. So the Sota is a fascinating tractate of the Talmud. Only about the first two-thirds, maybe a little less, talks about the whole ritual of the Sota. I mean, obviously, there are always side topics. But the last three chapters have nothing to do with Sota. It has to do with the Sota ritual had to be said in Hebrew. So the Mishnah lists off all the things you can say in Hebrew and all the things you can say in any language. So the Mishnah says you can daven in any language. You can pray whatever language you want. You can say Berchat HaMazon in any language you want. But different things have to be said. Mikra Bikurim, when the farmer brings his first fruit, that's what we read in 2 weeks, Hebrew. And so here the Egla Arufa, this also I think has to be in Hebrew. So that's what it's doing here. So the Gemara says, does anybody in their right mind think that the members of the Beit Din are Shofchei Damim. So I'm not 100% sure I have that same incredulousness of the Gemara. Is it possible that a member of the court actually killed somebody? I don't know that that's such a rhetorical question, but to the sages of the Talmud, it was. Unfortunately, we know there are religious leaders, whatever, I don't want to get into it, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility that religious extremism can lead to murder. But let's leave that aside. Does anybody think a qualified Beit Din, a real Beit Din, a Sanhedrin, that killed him? Ella lo re, so it can't mean that. What it means, Ella lo re inu patruno below mezonot below Libya. It means we escorted him. In other words, we saw him. And maybe, you know, strangers in towns, nobody paid attention. They let him go alone at night. And here the Gemara is the whole thing, how important it is to escort your guest. And so the sage, nobody, of course, thinks the sages killed. But maybe the sages did not escort this person, didn't give them food, and therefore they're responsible. That's really what the Mishnah is saying. I mean, it's a very powerful idea that through their passivity and not doing anything, they have to get some of the blame. It's considered as if they spill blood. Obviously, it's not the same, but the Torah phrases it, what do you mean they spill blood? They were the indirect cause of spilling blood. So I don't know if, Tovar, you remember the speech that Uncle Israel gave. I forget it, who Simcha. One of our cousins, my uncle was a rabbi in Hamilton, and one of the Simchas of his grandchild, I don't remember, I think it was a bat mitzvah, was outside of Detroit, I think, and with the camp. Anyways, whatever it was, and it was on Parshat Shoftim, the end of the summer, and he said, what happens if the rabbis can't say that? In other words, the rabbis say, we gave him food, we escorted him, okay, it's not our fault. Because, you know, had we not given him food, had we not escorted the person, it would have been as if he murdered him. But, you know, sometimes the rabbis can't say that. Sometimes it's actually true that they didn't escort him. In other words, the way we have to proclaim that we didn't kill him. Of course they didn't kill him. That's not what they have to proclaim. They have to proclaim they took him to his hotel room. They found a bed and breakfast for this person, and therefore they're not responsible. But maybe they can't say that. So I don't think he gave an answer to that question. He was just throwing out the response. Tova, do you remember that? You don't remember that? I'm sorry. Okay. So that's putting the great onus on the rabbis because that's their responsibility. And if they don't give them food, they don't escort you, you are they're almost considered guilty of murder. It's a very, very high standard. Okay, that's just very, yeah. You wanted to ask something?
A dumb question. But a guy probably dead in between two towns. You find him. How do you know in which direction you were going?
I don't know which direction who was going in. I'm sorry.
The guy that died.
The guy that we don't know. We find the dead body. We don't know how the dead body got here, right? That's why. What does this ritual do? So that's what I said. Some say it's to publicize it. Is it to find who the murder? First of all, who knows if he was even murdered? I mean, that's the assumption. And the Gemara has all kinds of exceptions. How you have to find him and where and what. It's not our topic for now. But you find a dead body. It's kind of like, if you want to put in another thing, when somebody kills somebody by accident, and you know they killed them by accident. Ari Miklat. So if somebody, God forbid, the Gemara, it's actually also this week's Parsha. Actually, that was not on my talk. This week's Parsha. If you're chopping wood and the wood goes flying and the tree goes flying and it kills somebody accidentally. So you got to go to an Ari Miklat, right? How long do you have to stay in the Ari Miklat? How long do you have to stay in the Ari Miklat for?
Till the Kohen Gadol
dies. Yeah, what does that do with anything? It's ridiculous. Until the Kohen Gadol dies. It could be 2 weeks. It could be 50 years. Wait until the Kohen Gadol dies. What in the world is the connection between the Kohen Gadol dying and you leaving an Ari Miklat? So this is a very, very powerful, this is a more powerful than Agla Rufa. Basically, the way I was taught, the way I understand this, is that the Kohen Gadol is responsible. He's the religious leader. When something goes wrong under your watch, you are responsible, even if it's totally not your fault. right? Can the Kohen Gadol stop every accident? You know, there's no such thing as accidents. That's what the Torah says. You build a fence around your house. You got, you know, there's, if you're careful, nobody's going to get killed by somebody chopping wood. And no tree, and you're not going to have this, I see they released in England this awful fire of 7 years ago. So 70 people killed, the incompetence, the corruption, the deregulation. It's not an accident, it's murder. It's murder. So, okay, so not every accident is almost cold-blooded murder, but every accident is a little bit of negligence. And even if it's not the Kohen Gadol, it wasn't the Kohen Gadol who built a bad roof or who built a bad axe. The axe didn't put up, but he's the leader of the society. So he has to make sure there are people to go to every store and nobody's allowed to sell an axe that it's possible that the blade is going to go flying off. I mean, that's really what the Torah is saying. The religious leadership, if somebody dies, it's the Kohen Gadol's fault. What was Kohen Gadol to do with anything? Nothing. It's his fault because he did not create a society that he's the leader and he has to create followers and he's got to create a whole band of followers who are going to make sure no accidents happen. So it's a punishment of the, I mean, it's that, that's how it's generally explained. And the Mishnah says, you know, the famous Mishnah, it's so cute. The mothers of the Kohen Gadol would bake cake to bring to the people in the Ari Miklat. Because they shouldn't pray that the Kohen, obviously you're going to pray the Kohen Gadol is going to die. I mean, yes, you are going to pray for that. That's normal. That's a normal thing to do. You're stuck in jail. It's not exactly a jail, but Ari Mikla was a normal city, by the way. People, it's this week's Parsha. We're going to talk about it, but the Ari Mikla is a normal city. It's just you can't leave it. So imagine you live in, I don't know, where do people live? Imagine you live in Teaneck. Okay, it's a nice little town. I was just there last week for a day or so, whatever. And it's in that nice little town. But if you could never leave, I don't know, what's it between, what are the streets there? I forget the names of the streets there. Between Cedar Lane and whatever. You got to live your whole life within that square mile, you know, where there are 97 kosher restaurants and 55 shuls. And, you know, okay, it would be awful. You never leave. You're in jail. It's whatever. So they pray, but he had to live a normal life. He had to live a normal life. And the Mishnah says, what happens if he comes to shul? So it's a nice shul. The Gabbai sees him and he offers him an aliyah. That's actually in the Mishnah, in the Yerushalmi. They offer him an aliyah because he walks into shul. He's a murderer. He's a manslaughterer. He's an accidental murderer. And because that's how the Torah calls him. The Torah calls him a rotseach. Again, the Torah is putting heavy responsibility. We don't consider him a murderer. It was an accident, but no, the Torah says you're a murderer. So he comes to shul. So they go, a new guy in shul, the Gabbai gives him an aliyah. So the Mishnah says the person who killed by accident must say, Rotseach ani. You know what, to people to admit it to yourself, it's like you have to do tshuva, you have to do vidui. It's not enough to think, you have to say, Hashem lebagana. You're really supposed to say the actual sin. It's very hard. People can't admit it. You know, if I did anything wrong to you, I'm sorry. What do you mean, if you did? You did something wrong, admit it. Right? We have a tremendous hard time. So this guy who accidentally killed somebody has to tell the Gabbai in Shul, don't give me an aliyah, Rotseachani, I'm a murderer. And the Mishnah then continues beautifully, I mean, if you want to use that word, and the guy says, it's okay, we give murderers aliyahs in this Shul. Like, it's okay, fine, we're going to rehabilitate you, it's okay. They're allowed to give him an aliyah, but they have to know, maybe they don't want to give him an aliyah. And the Mishnah says, just another same idea, his Rebbe has to go leave yeshiva and give him a shir every week. I don't know on Zoom. I don't know if Zoom would count. Presumably it wouldn't count. The Mishnah says, why? It says, v'chai shem, he has to live there. And without a teacher, you're not living. It's a beautiful, it's a very important idea. So he has to be, he can't leave, but he has to live a normal life. We're not going to punish, you know, that's it. And living a normal life means having a teacher. But again, it's the teacher's fault. How can a teacher have a student who can speed 20 miles over the limit? I mean, you know, so many people saw these, this hockey player, Goudreau, whatever his name was killed last week. I'm sure a lot of people saw in the paper. Very tragic. It was the night before his sister's wedding and the two brothers were home and they were riding on the bike and a drunk driver hit them from behind and kill them. People don't know what I'm talking about. So here, yeah. Right. Very tragic. Happened in New Jersey. I mean, all these things are tragic. So what we're saying, it's that his teacher is the fault. I mean, you know, because how can it be? How can you have a student? So the responsibility of Elder Rufa is amazing, amazing. But you have it in all kinds of instances. Now we're going to take the instance where the Jewish people have the Egla Arufa. So I think, so who knows Rabbi Benjamin Blech? People know he is. People know him, met him. He's retired. He's in his late 80s now, I believe. I think Baruch Hashem, I hope. At last I heard he's doing quite well. So I'm going to show you, Benjamin Blech wrote an amazing article. In the Torah Umada Journal, that's the, I don't think it exists anymore. It's part of tradition years ago. They put out the journal in the first issue. So let me just show you very briefly the article. You can read it on your own afterwards. It's not that long. Where do we have it here? Give me a second. Everything gets in the way here. My pictures are in the way. Why is this not good? Hold on a second. Okay, there we go. YU Torah. Okay. Here, personal growth or community responsibility, question of prayer. I believe this is 1989. Yeah, January 1st, 1989. Some 30 years ago, I attended the yeshiva in which I learned Torah full-time, day and night. At one point, so this is 1960, right? Like, okay, because this article is already 35 years old. So this is where it's going 65 years ago. It makes sense. He's in his late 80s. He's in his 20s. He was learning in yeshiva. At one point, I informed the Rosh Yeshiva that I want to go to Yeshiva University in order to become a Rav. Their response in almost these exact words was Chas v'shalom. You must sit and learn and become a Gadol Hador. I told them I wanted to become a rabbi so I could teach and help people in ways that only a rabbi can, but they insisted my obligation was to remain in yeshiva and become a gadol. I argued that by following their advice, I wouldn't be accomplishing anything for anyone else, but they maintained that was my religious responsibility to become as learned as I could be. I was to become the greatest Talmud Chacham possible, which could only happen if I sat and learned Torah day and night for the rest of my life. The yeshiva world has changed a little since 1990. They don't have that negative attitude towards rabbinate, which they used to have. I did not do what they wanted me to do. Anyway, so his whole, then he's going to give a whole drasha on the Egla Arufa. This article is a whole talk on the Egla Arufa, and he explains what is the sin of the Egla Arufa. Actually, he says, he quotes an idea from Rav Soloveitchik that every sort of story in the Torah has a halachic counterpart. In other words, any halachic story, there's a relationship between stories and, you know, the halacha, like we know today in Israel, a lot of scholarship, the agadot of the Gemara are placed in certain tractates in the Talmud. It's not by coincidence. The halacha and the agada inform each other. So he says, when you think of the Egla Rufa, so the Egla Rufa is the halacha. What story does the Egla Rufa remind you of?
Chet
Egel. Very good. So what's the relationship between Chet? That's very nice. It's good. Egel, but you need a little bit more. What's the connection between Chet Egel and Egla Rufa?
Tavo ima v'techaper al ha'egel.
There's one medrash like that the mother kept. That's the Para Aduma, though. That's not the Egla Rufa. The medrash says by Para Aduma, the mother is the par, the Egel is the child. So the mother cleans up the dirt of the child. The Para Aduma is Matari, but we're not talking about the Para Aduma. We're talking about the Egla Rufa. We're talking about the Egla Rufa.
Is the responsibility that the people around town.
Very good.
Taking responsibility.
First of all, so explain that. Explain what you mean.
Okay. By Cheta Egel, Aaron never really took full responsibility. I cannot say direct, indirect. It told Moshe,
not the approach he takes. Interesting. He doesn't discuss it from the perspective of Aaron.
He's allowed to. I'm allowed to.
I'm just saying. That's not Aaron, right? Aaron's role is very controversial. We're not going to go there now, maybe at the end if we have a few minutes. But first of all, you already know it's the word kaper, kapara. Okay, we'll get that now. So he explains like this. Let's take a look at Chet Egel, and let's just quickly take a look at a few psukim in the Chumash. And it's like everything. We never look at the Chumash. He actually says something cute here. If I remember the article, I did make a decision. Okay, let us take a look. I know I can impress you more if I quote a Chazon Ish or a Rashba or other Rishonim and Achronim. Please forgive me if I'm simplistic enough to use as a sort of as pashut as the Chumash itself. I just find that such a cute line. Just let's look at the Chumash. Don't give me any Rav Chaims here. Okay. So the Chet Egel happens, God tells Moshe, Moshe prays, Moshe knows when he comes down the mountain it's going to be bad because God has already warned him. He's already pleaded for the Jewish people. But it's one thing to know about it, something else. He knew the Jewish people built a golden calf, but it's not the same as when he actually saw it. That's why he didn't break the luchot up top. He broke the luchot only at the bottom. So Moshe comes down. He's pretty mad. Right, he's pretty mad, and he's mad at Aaron. But so Aaron says to Moshe, "Don't get mad at me. Well, what do you want from me? The people are nuts. They forced me to do. They needed a god. It just happened, you know. Especially I threw it in the fire. No, Nagel happened. This is like that's an excuse, you know. Your 4-year-old kid gives you, you know, like I threw it in the fire, and lo and behold, a calf came out. Yeah, really? Okay. Anyways, so Moshe says, okay, he's not. Please. Moshe said, we're going to have a civil war here. Mila Shem Elive, Yisraelav Koban Levi. And the Levim came. The Levim, we know, already violent. Shevet Levi from Shechem. They just transferred their violence. I want to say more positive. I don't know. It's not exactly. But it's not a coincidence. These are the same B'nai Levi. In other words, very much like that. The Shvatim follow.
They channeled it. They channeled it.
But I don't know that this is so great either, but it's okay. It's better than in Shechem. So they went and they killed the people. There was a civil war. And they killed their friends and they killed their brothers, their relatives. It's pretty sad. I mean, it's a terrible verses. That's what they did. How many people did they kill? The funny expression, kishloshet.
Yeah.
Around 3,000. They didn't take an exact count. Like, around 3,000 people were killed. Okay? So what happens? Vayhimi Macharat. It was on the next day. Vayomer Moshe, right? 3,000 people are dead. The story of the golden calf is finished. Vayomer Moshe La'am. Moshe says to the people, not to Aaron, Atem chata, tem chata, chata, you sinned a great sin. What do you mean you sinned a great sin? Bata Eli El Hashem, I'm going to go up to God. Ulai, maybe, Akapra, Kaper, that same word we have by the Egla Rufa, and the same word we see in Yom Kippur. Ulai Akapra Bat Chatatkan. Maybe God will forgive us. I don't understand. What sin? They just killed all the sinners. Not just the sin. It's a terrible sin. Atem Chata, Tem Chatatkan. Moshe is talking to the people who weren't killed, who did not participate in Cheda Egel. And he said, you did a great sin, and I'm going to have to go, and I'm not sure if God's going to forgive us. Ulai. Ulai means maybe. I don't know. God may think that your sin you did is so great, there's no forgiveness. And Moshe goes up to God. He said, I know the people did this awful sin. They built a god of gold. God, please, please forgive them. If you're not going to forgive them, write me off this book. I don't want to, I'm out of here. My mission with you is over. You forgive them or I'm out. That's a pretty strong language. I mean, Moshe let God have it, you know. I'm not partnering with you unless you forgive the people. And of course, this is what we have, and this is the origins of Yom Kippur. So Rabbi Blech asks a simple question. I don't understand. All the people who sinned, they're already dead. What was their sin? So obviously, I mean, by what we're saying, their sin was that the sin of the Egla Rupa. They didn't do anything. It was passive as being a sin. And then he distinguishes it between, and you get the point why he becomes a rabbi. You can sit there lamenting American assimilation, but if you're not going to go in the field and work, then you're the cause of it. You're sitting in the yeshiva and letting people intermarry and then not be from and just complaining how terrible they are. No, that's Chet Egel. I mean, he doesn't exactly say that, but you know, you don't have to be a nuclear psychic to figure that out. Yes.
Passive meaning one thing, but bystander, it's not the same. They were bystanders, but they were not passive. The same reason when Aaron and Moshe and Memeriva, what was Aaron's sin? Moshe did the hitting of the rock. What was Aaron's sin?
Right. What was Aaron's sin? Yeah. Aaron's yeah. So that's also a good, right. Right. That's a very good question, but it could also be that. Yeah. 100%.
All Israel were bystanders.
Yeah. So that's terrible. That's terrible. What,
that's what it is.
I don't know why. Now, what's her name? That's the famous case they used to talk about, although Katie Genesov, right? That's the famous case.
Katie Genovese.
Genovese, thank you. I just, right. That's the woman who was murdered when
right. And all the people didn't intervene.
Nobody intervened because everybody thought everybody else.
Somebody else would, right.
And we know that in psychology, when there's only one person there, you're much more likely to be saved than when they're 50. Because when they're 50, why isn't he doing it? Why do I have to do it? But if you're the only one, you'll do it. So, the Torah doesn't like that excuse. So Rabbi Blech goes on to say, this is the difference between Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. He asked the following question. He says, it says on Rosh Hashanah marks the beginning of Aseret Yemei Teshuva, at the beginning of 10 days of repentance. You go to shul, and what do you have to do? There was a debate, you know, what we're supposed to do on Rosh Hashanah. So the Gaonim, and my understanding is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, did like this. It's not common practice. It's a Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to do this, but they used to fast. How can you eat on Rosh Hashanah? It's Yom HaDin. God, the Miyachim, the Unetanakim, you're going to go home and eat a nice meal. Nonetheless, Jewish tradition and Jewish law as the accepted law for, you know, okay, Rav Chaim can do his own thing, that's all right. But was that you have to eat a fancy meal on Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because we're very confident that God heard our prayers. We go to shul, we do tshuva, you know, even though Rosh Hashanah is not really on tshuva so much. Rabbi Shulman's going to talk about that next week. But still, it's the beginning of Aseret Yemei Teshuva. We're confident that we were written in the Book of Life. We can go home and celebrate. He says, so why do you come back to shul on Yom Kippur? 10 days later, what are you all nervous about on Yom Kippur? You just were forgiven. For Rosh Hashanah, yikatevun. You know, like it's all good. It's all written down for good. Well, what do you need Yom Kippur for? So he says, what's Rosh Hashanah? Even without this piece, I think it works, but it's just an added piece, I think. Nice. What do we assume happened on Rosh Hashanah? Creation of the world, no, right? That's what we assume. Creation of mankind, whatever. And what happened on the first day of creation, according to the rabbis? Didn't take long. How long were they, Adam and Eve, in Gan Eden for?
Six hours?
Yeah, a few hours. Didn't take long. So Rosh Hashanah is the sin of eating from the Eitz Hadat. It says that's a sin of commission. They did something wrong. That's Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur is sins of omission. Yom Kippur is Cheta Egel. We are forgiven for Cheta Egel. Cheta Egel is a sin of not, you didn't do anything wrong. That's exactly the problem. You didn't do anything. You didn't do anything right either. So he says Rosh Hashanah is tshuva for sins of commission. Yom Kippur is tshuva for sins of omission. That's the story of Cheta Egel. And that's the halacha of Egla Arufa is picking up on the story of Cheta Egel that if you're passive, you're considered a murderer. And this explains why he became a rabbi. It's a beautiful article and it's a beautiful idea. You know, it's a little bit harsh, a little harif, but that's okay. In other words, Judaism is very high standards on the rabbis and the leadership. I'll add one little thing on this Egla Arufa that I always like. There's a I'm sure some of you have heard of the Midrash that when Yosef came back, not Yosef, when the brothers came back from Egypt to tell their father that Yosef was alive, so, you know, he had a heart attack. Vayafeg libo, like, obviously he had a heart attack. How could he not have a heart attack, right? And he didn't believe them. And then it says, Vayaret hakalot, he saw the wagons, because Joseph is the king of a viceroy. Fancy a golden, not a golden calf, but a golden wagon, and fancy schmancy. So it says, Vayaret hakalot, must be. And the Medrash has this ridiculous on the surface comment. What he said, it reminded him that we're learning Egla Rufa. That when Yaakov sent Yosef to Shechem, they were in the middle of learning the parsha of Egla Rufa. Agalot, of course, they have nothing to do with each other. One is a wagon. It's the same letters, but it's a totally different meaning. The Egel is a calf, but Agalot, Egel, Bayart, Agalot. Oh, yeah. Yosef was sending a message to his father to tell me, Vilay, remember, Daddy, we were learning about the Gemara in Sota about Egla Rufa? Right. So obviously what's going on here. So we know that we come from the school here where only fools take Midrashim, literally. We follow the Maimonidean approach. And, What's the Medrash saying? Medrash is saying Yaakov is kicking himself in the pants. Why are you asking? It's his fault. He didn't escort him. How dare he send him to Shechem, to his brothers, without escorting him? That's exactly what that's exactly what they have to say. Do we let him go without escorting him? So Yaakov Avinu, the Medrash is saying Yaakov Avinu did the sin. They did the mistake of the Yegla Rufa. He didn't escort Yosef. Vayar Takalot, they reminded him. I think it's such a beautiful, it's again, a powerful and a very harsh Midrash, really, very harsh on Yaakov, but that's really what it's saying. Yeah, so you say Yaakov, he didn't think that, whatever pshat you want to give, but that's how that Midrash understands it. Okay, that's enough on the Egla Arufa.
Rabbi, yes. May I ask one question? Why the person who hamazeh et mehanida, why he is the mehada erev?
You're talking again on the Paraduma, right? No?
No. I'm Paraduma. You're right. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm talking about that. Right. Why the Paraduma makes the person impure. Okay. Let's just talk about the truth. Rather, is the entire Parsha is on leadership. Shoftim v'shotrim. Those, I don't think it's out yet, but it should be out later tonight. My podcast this week is on rabbinic authority. Lota Sermin Hadavar, when they have to listen to the rabbis. Of course, it's a very important topic. How do we understand rabbinic, what happens when the rabbis make mistakes? Lotasser, and what's the application of listening to rabbis? And of course, we have the notion of a king. In this week's parsha, I'll just say one thing, Tova. I'm not going to put you on the spot again, but I don't know. I don't know if you were with us, but I imagine you were, because if I was there, you were probably there. I know I'm picking on my sister. It's not nice. But many, many years ago, when we used to go to Binghamton every summer, because my uncle was a professor at SUNY, and they lived in Binghamton. We used to drive to New York because my father had three siblings in New York and one sibling in Binghamton, and whatever. So we would always stop in Binghamton on the way and occasionally spend a Shabbos in Binghamton, often not, whatever. But we'd always spend at least a night in Binghamton on the way to New York. My aunt is, whatever, she's actually the only remaining person in that generation. She's the only, and I just saw her when I was in Israel now in the summer. She's in the 90s in nursing home, whatever. She had for shame, but her two children made Aliyah. Anyway, so Rabbi Groner, I don't know if Rabbi Groner was the rabbi in Shul Binghamton. He too made Aliyah. He worked in Malei Adumim for many years. He was the executive director of Malei Adumim. I don't know. I haven't heard from him. Tova, you know, have an idea what's with Rabbi Groner? Okay. Anyways, if anybody knows. So I remember we were in Shul on Parsha Shoftim, and he spoke about whether it's a mitzvah to appoint the king or not. So this is a big debate. The Rambam is a big believer in the king, and the Abarbanel is a big non-believer in king. Kings are terrible because power corrupts. And this is, I mean, even the fact that you could have such a machloket is in and of itself is fascinating. But that's the richness of our tradition that, you know, there's a verse in the Torah, and some people say this is great. It's an obligation. Some people say this is terrible. Like, it's really wild. So Rabbi Groner, I remember what he explained. He says like this. It says in the Torah, how did the Jewish people phrase it? It says, just let me find the pasuk. Ki palei mimcha, no, it's the next one, right?
Liyot kemo.
Yeah, yeah. Yot kemo. Bamarta, ki tavol arche sher shemokacha notin lech v'yushtav v'yishabta. But when you come to the land that God has commanded you and you dwell in it, Bamarta, and you say, asim alai melech, I'm going to appoint the king. Like all the nations who are around me. Is that good or bad? Is that a good statement or bad? So he says, you can't know. That's the whole debate. I thought it was a beautiful thing. Are you doing it because we're like the goyim? If the goyim do it, we do it. Ah, we don't care if it makes sense. The goyim do it. Everybody does it. That's terrible. Say, you know, no, the goyim, you know, the goyim are smart. Yesh chachma b'goyim. Tell me, you have to leave. We don't know. We're a new nation. We're slaves. What do we know about governing? We don't know anything. We blew it. We had a whole generation die. We don't know anything about governance. Ooh, let's look around. Well, that makes sense. We want to do kechol agoyim, not to copy them, but to learn from them. So then it's a great thing. So I just found that very interesting, that it really has to do with sort of the tone of how you read those words. Is it kechol ha'goyim asher sivavotai, like, I just want to copy them? Or no, it's like, let's learn from them. But anyway, that is a big debate. I will say we started the shiur saying Rav Kook's yortzeit. It is Rav Kook, I believe, who pretended to do that king doesn't mean a king. A king means Jewish rulers. And therefore, the Israeli Knesset, Rav Kook died before 1935. For all the feminists in the room, Rav Kook is like all great people. People are products of their times. And, Rav Kook was very much against women voting. Maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe people won't like him anymore. But Rav Kook felt women were not allowed to vote. I wish the Haredim would do that. I shouldn't say that. But can you imagine if they wouldn't vote? They'd have to see. Oh my God, I'm going to get into trouble now. But Rav Kook was against women voting. Remember, he dies in 1935. When did Canada allow women to vote? 1924? Anybody know? I think Canada allowed women's vote, suffrage, women's vote. So, like, it's not a big deal. Everybody was against women voting, but it's just interesting. But Rav Kook felt that when you elect the government, that's in a democratic fashion, a king doesn't have to be a king the way we think. It can be any leader of Jewish people have the status of a king. And that's, I think, his son developed this idea. Obviously, this plays into all religious Zionism and our attitude towards the state, et cetera, et cetera. If it has the status of a melech, then of course you're not allowed to defy the king. So whatever, that's as an aside for Rav Kook's yortzeit, I'll just mention. I'm not totally familiar with all the nuances of his belief. Rav Zevin has written this up, and Rav Zevin in Le'or Halacha, what's his less famous book, Modim Halacha is his very famous book, Le'or Halacha, where he writes articles on halachic topics. He has about, I read it like a long time ago, so I don't have to read it again. But he has like an 80-page essay or maybe more on war, modern warfare and halacha. Maybe I should read it again, but it's really fascinating. And there he discusses Rav Kook's view on what's the status of a melech, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, we'll end with one last idea that I always like. Again, when the Torah says we have to listen to our sages, whatever that means, whether it only applies to a Sanhedrin, what happens if you don't listen? What happens if you don't listen? What does it say in the Torah? What's it says in the Torah, and then what happens in practice? Ba'ish, it says, al pi ha'Torah she'erucha, lo taser min ha'davar. I'll share my screen because,
a Yazid below Yishma, isn't it?
Right. The person, where are we going here? 17. Okay, Vukalech, where am I going here? Below these, but this is the beginning of the Parsha, I think, right? Abata Lakonim. Okay, al pi ha'Torah she'er yerucha. You have to follow what the sages say. And someone who willfully ignores their ruling, he's not going to listen. Who cares what they say? Mate doesn't mean he dies. It means you kill him. Of course, we know that death penalties weren't given often. Now, even though the simple meaning of the verse means anybody who defies the Sanhedrin, we're not talking about some rabbi, the Sanhedrin, we don't have that anymore, defies the Sanhedrin, gets a death penalty, the rabbinic interpretation, it's only if a Supreme Court justice, only if a member of the Supreme Court defies. If me or you defies the court, big deal. But you understand if the U.S. Supreme Court votes 6-3, like they usually do these days, and one of the three decides that we're going to ignore the law and we're going to follow that, they get a death penalty because they're undermining the whole system. Can't have a judge undermine the system. So even though it says anybody, because that's the way the Torah taught, because the Torah wants the message to be for everybody, but in halakhically, we only kill the member of the Sanhedrin who defies the ruling of the Sanhedrin. Doesn't matter what the issue is. The issue can be a minor nothing. It's the defying. It's like, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. That is the bad part. Now, we call this person a Zakein Mamre. A Zakein means an elder, means a wise person, a member of the court. Mamre, a rebel. Hilchon Mamrim, the laws of rebels. So here's this halacha that I love this halacha, one of my favorite halachot. So you're on the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin votes 48-23. There's 71 people. 48-23 is some vote. And you're the 23, and you think they're wrong. You think they're wrong, but you know you can't defy them because it destroys the system. So you're not allowed to defy them. But what are you allowed and maybe even obligated to do? You have to write an op-ed in the New York Times, and you have to explain. I mean, that's a modern thing. It can be in the Wall Street Journal too, or the Globe and Mail. You have to, or Jerusalem Post. You have to write an op-ed why the court is wrong, why we have to listen to the court, but why I think they're wrong. In other words, if as long as the Zakein says, we're going to listen because society can't function if everybody does what they want. Even if I think they're wrong, we have to listen. And everybody, we have to, you know, like a good leader, you have to prevent dissension and we have to listen. But here's why I think they're wrong. And maybe they'll reconvene and say why and change their mind. They'll take another vote and they'll change their mind. And I think this is such the intellectual honesty that you can tell a person what to do, but you can't tell a person what to think. You can't tell a person that, oh, I think that, what do you mean? No, I think you're wrong. I'm not going to change my view just because you ruled in a certain way. I will follow you because I understand the Torah demands that. The Torah requires a system like that. So I think that's really a beautiful, it's an important idea. Today we talk about rabbinic authority and, you know, Das Torah and, you know, this rabbi said this and the whole world has to, you know, listen and nobody's allowed to contradict. Of course you can contradict. The whole Lithuanian tradition, I don't know what happened to it, was to argue with, I mean, you read the stories, you read Shaul Stamper's book on the Lithuanian yeshivas, I mean, your hair will stand on edge. What the people did, they threw out the Rosh, they would yell at them, they had no respect. I mean, when I say no respect, in other words, it's like Nechama Lee was always still it. The Torah doesn't respect people. If somebody did something wrong, there's no respect for a person. Obviously, we respect them, but not in the sense of we're not afraid to say we think you're wrong. And that was the traditional approach always. And that's I mentioned Rav Moshe's introduction to Grand Moshe. You have to be an independent thinker and you have to say what you want. When it comes to practice, that's a communal issue. That's a slightly different issue, but it's very important. Everybody's allowed and obligated. You have to say what you think. And I've mentioned many times, we had it, the pasuk in Parshat Dvarim, Lo Taguru Mifnei Ish, where the Torah also talks about Shoftim V'Shotrim back then. And it says, do not be afraid of anybody. The judge cannot be afraid of anybody. And they quote in the name of, I think it's Rav Chaim Volozhin, that Rav Yosef Karo was also an Ish. That if you believe the Shulchan Aruch, not me, but you know, a learned person, if Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Moshe Feinstein believes the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, they're obligated to say we believe the Shulchan Aruch is wrong. They ought to be afraid of Rav Yosef Karo. They can be afraid of the Rambam. Yeah, you take it and do it concern. So that was the notion. So that's what the Torah tells us. You have to follow. Sometimes we can't always practice what we think, in a sense, because we have greater societal obligations. But the way we think, that always goes. Okay, it's 9:28. Let's very quickly wrap up. We just talked the importance of Elul, of Gimel Elul, Rav Kook, and Nechama Leibowitz's birthday, and went to Rav Soloveitchik in Berlin, and Rav Kook, of course, the founder. So much of what goes on today in Israel and the religious Zionist world is based on the teaching of Rav Kook. But we spent most of the time talking about Egla Arufa. The rabbis are responsible, leaders are responsible, even if they're not at fault. It's a message that many people in Israel have not heard since October 7th. I didn't get political until now, don't mean to get political, but it's obvious that you're at fault even if it's not your fault. You're responsible even if it's not your fault, and the Torah takes that to a great extreme. You accidentally kill somebody, you're considered a murderer, and you have to say you're a murderer, and the Kohen Gadol can't, you're going to pray for him to die, because if there's an accident under his watch, it's his fault. He had nothing to do with it. He didn't create the climate where an accident cannot happen. And of course, the rabbis have to say, we didn't kill him. Well, you didn't kill him. If you didn't give him food and you didn't escort him to his house, it's as if, it's obviously not the same, it's as if you killed him. That said, what do you say? Sometimes the rabbis can't say that. Sometimes the rabbis really cannot say we escorted him, because so they're in metaphorically guilty of murder. It's a very powerful lesson, but it's an important lesson of of the Torah, and that's the difference between Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the Cheta Egel, the Egel Rufus, because it's the we killed the ringleaders, but it's the people who did nothing. That's who Moshe's praying for. It's a very powerful lesson. It's hard to do this. And Rosh Hashanah, that we ate from the fruit. Okay, we did something wrong. We engaged in things we weren't allowed to do. No. So that we can. That's not so hard. It's not always easy. But sins of commission, of course, are much worse. Bystanders, and we all know that. We all see things going on. I'm not going to get involved. It's not for me. But that's what you have to do. And that's why people become a rabbi. I don't know. That's Rav Lichtenstein. We learned by Rav Lichtenstein. They used to give every year on Purim. I didn't learn in Gush, but it's well known that the Rav Lichtenstein would talk every year on Purim, and he would quote Mordechai's plea to Esther. If you are silent now, the Jewish people will be saved. I don't know how, but Jewish people will be saved. It's like a and who knows, maybe this is why you were made the queen. And I think that's what he would always quote. We have a responsibility. He would try to convince people to go into chinuch, into rabbanis, to take people who are qualified. People who aren't qualified should do other things, but those who are qualified should do that. So that's an important message. Parsha Shoftim is all about leadership. We need leadership, but we need leadership that takes responsibility for what they do. And we all can be active, and we're all leaders in our own ways. And we should be active and can't let things go on that aren't good without speaking up. Okay, thank you very much. Just a reminder, tomorrow my shiur starting a half an hour late. For those who come 9:45, I apologize for that, but whatever, like I have to... something came, actually, what happened is one of the teachers away had a missed school, and they asked me to fill in for a class, and it's whatever, I felt bad, so I'm filling in for a couple of weeks, so whatever, so the class ends at 9:30, so but to get home, so that's why, if I have to know why, but I mean, whatever. Okay, anyways, okay, are there any questions? Google said in the Chamali, which we discussed that, the original Scarlet Letter, which I forget about, okay, thank you, hold on, in what context were you saying that? Said that, I forget.
The murderer, the shogay, has to announce what he's done. It's like he's wearing a scarlet letter.
Okay, right. Okay, thank you. Okay, I had to think what the scarlet letter was for a second. That's okay.
But not for murder.
I'm sorry?
The scarlet letter was not for murder.
Right. No, they have this judges sometimes who do things like that. They make people stand in the public square to embarrass them. That's like a terrible thing. It's anyways. I think it is the story of the brothers bringing Yosef's blood strip coats. I'm not sure what that's referring to. Oh, that's the why we bring Seiri Zim Echad Lechatat on every single Yontif. We bring Seiri Zim Echad Lechatat, and that's a reminder of the Yosef story, of course. What's in every we don't bring it on Shabbat, but Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, with the Korban Musaf always consists of a Seiri Zim Echad Lechatat, a sin offering of a goat dipped in blood, and that's, of course, the Yosef story. That's the whole, our holidays, Omaha went to Egypt, and that's also another powerful idea combining two. Okay, I'm glad Ruth and I think alike, although I'm not sure what you were thinking the same with me, but the same thing went on the... on passiveness, passivity. I made a note of the Yosef story in my Tanakh in this Parsha. I see I made a note of the Yosef story.
Oh no, that was a response to Milton's comment.
Oh,
on
okay.
Oh.
Yeah, and I did have that because it's the Yosef is the, it's the combination of the Agalot and the Egla. So that's all about Yosef. And Yosef is the, you know, well, he's not an Egel exactly, but he was like a lost, like a dead body, although there wasn't a dead body. And no one claimed, none of the brothers would say anything about what happened to him. They all said, oh, we had nothing to do with this. But of course, they all had something to do with it.
Right. Everybody, you know, when there are people, everybody looks around, there's somebody else. Yeah. That's human nature. It's very hard. Okay. Somebody asked you to put the article on of Rabbi Blech's article, so I just put it there. I maybe can get it in a few places. I got it through YU. Can get it probably on Tradition, online, whatever, but it's a YU. I just type in Rabbi Blech or something on I forget what I typed in, but okay, but personal growth or community responsibility, a question of priorities, that's the article. It was the first issue of the Torah Mudah Journal, which was so that's that. And okay, well, everybody, wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom. We should hear good news and should have good leadership and good followers. We need a lot of that. And let's pray that whatever the leaders will make the right decision. The leaders can only do what the followers let them to do. It's not easy to be a leader of the Jewish people. So we look tonight at the leadership, but sometimes you have to look at the people too. So anyways, all right. And those who can make it tomorrow morning, 9:45, the Elul program, I guess, is a lot of our new shirim are starting next week. A lot of the Elul program is starting next week. I'm sure you've all seen the emails, but you can take a look. So we'll have a full schedule. I think 10 classes next week. I don't remember exactly, and a number of new series starting. Okay, so wish everybody Laila Tov.
Thank you.
Thank you. Shabbat
Shalom.
Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Laila Tov. Shabbat Shalom.
Laila Tov. Shabbat Shalom. Toda v'vakasha. Okay. Bye bye.